You're listening to Every Voice Matters with Dori Francis, only on LA Talk Radio.
Hi, everyone. Good morning. I'm Dori Francis, and this is Every Voice Matters, and every voice does matter. So please reach out and let me know if you'd like to be on the show. We are booking into next year, but we have so many amazing guests coming, and I'm really excited about how well the show is growing. Today, I want to thank Lake Tahoe Preparatory School for supporting and sponsoring today's show. Lake Tahoe Preparatory School meets students where they are in their academic journey. They champion lifelong intellectual curiosity, physical fitness, and personal resilience. They achieve 100% university acceptance, and their students graduate ready to learn, ready to launch, and ready to lead. You can look at their beautiful website with a lot of information at laketahoeprep.org. You can also schedule a campus visit, and you can do that by calling 530-583-8665. I'd like to introduce my guest for today, Lenore Borion, Esquire of Counsel, Special Education Attorney. Hi, Lenore. Thank you for being here.
Hi, Dori. Thanks for inviting me.
So as a lawyer and former certified speech pathologist, Lenore is uniquely qualified to advocate on behalf of her clients in forms ranging from the Office of Administrative Law to the federal courts. She is passionately advocating for the needs of special education students throughout the state of New Jersey, enforcing their rights under both state and federal law. And as a part of this advocacy, she is a member of the Child and Adolescent Committee of the Brain Injury Alliance of New Jersey. I wanted to make sure I got that right, which created an award-winning program called Brain Injury Basics. And she is working with the New Jersey Y Camp Round Lake Committee, which plans for sleepaway camp for special needs students. And there's so much to Lenore. I want to make sure, though, that we have time to learn more about her today, to learn more about her journey. She's got two special cases she wants to talk about and share. And let's just start off with saying good afternoon and learning a little bit more about your journey and how you ended up doing what you're doing today. Thank you for being here.
Again, thank you for being here and good afternoon. So, standing on one foot version of the journey is that I started out in college as a education major. And just planned to teach early childhood education. I always loved the little ones, and it was just very exciting to watch them grow and learn in the short time that you had them in a class. And halfway through college, as things happen, scheduling problems exist, and there was a class, speech for education majors that was supposed to be a senior elective that you take while you're student teaching. But it fit into my schedule. Other things didn't. So I took it. And my professor said, "You're really good at this and you have plenty of time. Why don't you take more classes?" And I was like, "Okay." You're really good at this. You know, everybody likes to hear that when you're a young adult and, haven't figured everything out. And so sure enough, I delved into it more and fell in love with speech pathology. I went on to get a master's in speech pathology and, went to work right away after graduation thinking that's what I'm going to do. And where I ended up working was we now call them child study teams in most states. Something else, something similar, but it's, the team that diagnoses children and makes placement recommendations, and they used to call it evaluation and placement. Mm-hmm. And in those, and they, now they're decentralized. Now they're in the schools. Each school has its own team, or they share a team with another school, especially here in New Jersey. New York has a little bit different setup still. And we worked with kids, and I ended up doing some evaluations, but most of my time was working with a group of children that nobody really wanted to make a snap judgment and say, oh, they should be in this class or that. There was just so many interesting, intricate complexities. They came up with the concept of having a class where you, a diagnostic classroom, which was just, you know, really an extraordinary idea, and I wish it would come back. And then New York City being what it was, there was, you know, teacher layoffs and all that kind of stuff.
What year was all this taking place?
I got my master's in 74 and went right to work. So I think after one full year, there were layoffs.
Oh. So
that got interrupted. But then I got back to it. And there were child study teams were basically being mostly centralized in a, you know, per school district, or I forget exactly, or regional or whatever. And then periodically, somebody got the bright idea, well, let's get them out into the schools, because in some communities, it's very difficult for them to transport themselves to our location. And so we started doing that kind of work. And then there was, the law was still very new. For those who are in the special education world, the original law was 94-142, and it was very new. And all these time frames to get the evaluation done within 90 days and do this and do that, where, you know, we weren't really ready for the onslaught of cases. It got rather chaotic. And I started thinking, well, I don't know if I want to do this. This is really getting, there's no real direction here. I don't know if I want my boss's job or my boss's boss's job down the line.
Did you find that it was a lot of clinical work in what you were doing?
Yeah, I was testing kids, and I was chairing the child study team meetings that would make the placement decisions. And we had parent representatives. So somebody who had already been through the process and their child had an IEP would volunteer and come be the parent's emotional support at these meetings, right, which is also a wonderful concept that's no longer in existence. So, and through that, and through partnering with the other people on the team. So one of the two things I want that, you know, the cases that really exemplify kind of pulling everything together in my career, one of them is about kids who have very complicated language-based learning disabilities, which I handle a lot of those cases because of my background. And they have other ways to display their intelligence. Not everybody displays it the same way. So the whole concept of how do we look at nonverbal intelligence was demonstrated to me back then. And it's I'm sadly finding I'm pushing a boulder uphill in school districts here in New Jersey all these years later.
And it's not just in New Jersey. It's in so many school districts
across, I would imagine,
the United States. It's just like you said, I like the statement that you just said, that not everybody learns in the same way. Intelligent children do not always learn in the same way.
And absolutely not. And then, of course, the other end of the spectrum, talking about every voice, goes all the way up to the twice exceptional child, which I'll talk about a little later also, who is very bright, very high IQ, but definitely has a learning difference in one or more areas. Everybody's met that little professor, and back in the day, we used to say that it was Asperger's, and frankly, we still do because we know what we're talking about when we say Asperger's. And you've got the little professor. Everybody says, what are you talking about? You know, that child communicates. That child has language. They have language, but are they really communicating?
Right.
You know, is it really pragmatic and functional in all environments? So we've, you know, so we've traveled that everything in between. And so due to my frustration about what was going on in New York City, and we had due process hearings, one of the attorneys said to me, "Boy, you know, you come down here and your case is all ready to go. I don't have to do anything. Why don't you become a lawyer?" And, you know, went home and kind of kicked that one around with my then husband. And, you know, yeah, I kind of wanted to go to law school. My mother talked me out of it. You know. Maybe yes, maybe no. Of course, I did go to law school. And still, so now we're in the 80s, and I'm in law school, and it's still very political. And the women's movement was very political during those years. And, you know, again, trying to get our voices to matter. So I was in a very woman-friendly law school, but we were still pushing boulders uphill. And there was a lot of discouragement about going into something like education law, something that was, you know,
really?
Yeah, it was, you know, it was almost like pink collar, like don't be a nurse, be a doctor kind of thing, analogy. And I kind of went along with that and tried the other kinds of law. Actually, I was very interested in employment law and worked on equal pay for equal work. Cases. And I thought maybe that would be the direction I would go because I've always had a lifelong passion for equal rights of, you know, all kinds
advocating
of
advocating for people. I can see
right.
that. Yes.
So it was, you know, that was a matter of, you know, which way do I, you know, put, where do I put the accent? And the case I was working on with the, union in New York that, the 911 operators were suing because the firefighter emergency operators were mostly men and 911 were mostly women. The men got paid a lot more. So that ended up settling and that kind of dried up the market for for employee side attorneys. So, you know, I went into other kinds of corporate litigation and things that I didn't care for at all. Ended up taking the, I need a break from this. I got to be a mom a little later in life because I went to law school first and took the break. And then when I came back, I hit the glass ceiling.
Mm.
Not everybody was looking for somebody that had taken time off to raise
right.
a family. And so ended up the firm that made me the first offer was the firm that represented school districts of all things. And in my heart of hearts, I knew I'd much rather represent parents, but it was at a time where I really wanted to get back into law. And I said, well, you know, I'll kind of like learn how the other side thinks. And then maybe I will be more marketable to a parent side firm, which is what happened 18 months later. So I've been with Susan Greenwald and Wessler. I think I'm starting my 19th year.
Mm, that's a long time.
That's a long time. yeah. And that's, you know, so then within the firm, we all sometimes try to subspecialize in different areas, geographical or disability areas, you know, so that you have a collective understanding of how that district or how to deal with a certain disability, but we all represent all kinds of kids from all stripes.
What are the ages of the children that you mostly work with?
We work with the population from the age of 3 when they're eligible for public school for preschool disability programs. We help parents transition from early intervention if they're receiving that into preschool disability programs. And children are eligible for an education through June of their 21st birthday or when they receive a diploma, whichever comes first.
Okay.
So usually our north end is 21. Of course, with COVID, our governor signed a bill that gives the opportunity to stay on for a year or two, depending on the age of the child and the disability profile, which was a very welcome bill. We're happy about that. I have thought about and occasionally been approached about working with somebody who's not getting their reasonable accommodations at the college level. It just didn't really materialize, and we're busy. Even during COVID, we were busy. Not as busy as usual, be honest.
Yeah, did IEPs kind of come to a halt when they started doing online learning?
Yes and no. There really wasn't time to get things litigated because the courts closed down and then the judges were working remotely and they didn't have enough Zoom slowed down on that level. And in the whole time of the pandemic, I read one case from New York where the judge said the district didn't assess whether the child could access remote learning and therefore hadn't provided an appropriate IEP and needed to provide compensatory education. So in New Jersey, you know, pretty much they all ran to the courthouse steps and says, no, we're all going to do compensatory education. We're all going to have, you know, something for everybody. Don't sue us. So it just wasn't practical to sue about that. But at this point, most of them are back in and some were in hybrid and some are in person for the extended school year. But things have started to pick up. Parents are very concerned.
Yeah, I think everybody's trying to figure out what's going to happen when the school year starts. And it seems like from state to state, they're talking about different things. It's still uncertain, you know, even here in Colorado. We had such a huge influx of IEPs all of a sudden just coming to head in about the last 3 months. Because they just kind of were on hold during all of this COVID. You couldn't, like you said, you couldn't get people together. Or there wasn't enough platforms or Zoom time or availability or connections. And now that it seems that the school year is going to be restarting, everybody's just pouring in with wanting to get everything done and play catch up.
Yeah. Well, that's a whole unique situation that we'll just muscle through. But the State Department of Education here in New Jersey anyway said that free and appropriate public education is not waived because of the pandemic. And then what did that mean? It's not easy to define. Everybody, you know, that's everything that we litigate is appropriate. Right. What's appropriate. So.
And was that getting redefined?
Well, appropriate. For the pandemic.
Yeah.
Like I said, nothing really got litigated just on that. So I'm going to reserve judgment if I ever find anything out or just a case, I'll share it with you. But I would say, The one child that had like a little lab rat case. So on the one hand, the district got to present their side of the case in person. And then my first day of presenting witnesses was March 17th, 2020.
Oh.
And the courts closed on March 17th, 2020. So that was the end of my case. And then the board attorney wanted to kick the can down the road. So he only wanted to wait until we're back in person. And so the judge, you know, everybody thought it was going to be 8 weeks.
Of course. Very short.
Right.
Time. Right.
So everybody misjudged that.
Well, we had nothing to really measure against.
So, you know, then eventually we got, the judge squeezed the attorney and said, no, I want to hear this case.
Okay.
So we did my side of the case on Zoom. And I'm not a big fan.
Me neither.
It's tiring. As a former speech pathologist who studied the head and neck anatomy and all that crazy stuff that goes on in the brain. Yeah, you know, in a trial, you have the judge, you have the two attorneys, you have the two clients, you have the witness, and you might have the, you know, usually there's another box for the IT guy. And so you have, your brain is getting all these different light images all at the same time. And, you know, judges are looking for, they have to judge credibility. Okay. Everybody has, you know, people wrote their reports and people submitted their reports. So let's say for the, you know, sake of argument, for lay people, the report's in evidence. Every word of the report is in evidence, not for the truth of what it says, but it's there. And so what a judge needs to hear in a hearing on a due process case for special education is, why is that report the most important thing the judge is going to read in this case? And so the expert will talk about how they select the evaluations that they're going to do, their educational background, their experience, their resume of published articles and university teaching and things like that to kind of pump up that credibility situation. And then, of course, they're going to be looking at body language. Especially
on Zoom.
It's very hard on Zoom, especially on cross-examination. You know, how do you really know whether that question rattled that person? Most people are, you know, pretty good at fielding questions. There are, you know, people on the child study team, you know, they don't do this as often, you know, not that experts testify all the time, but it, you know, usually they're, like I said, teaching on the college level or doing something in addition to being experts from time to time. And so there's a certain poise and you just have to, you know, you turn your eye, you turn your head a drop on Zoom, and you're not getting that evil stare that I give in the courtroom when I'm examining you.
Yeah.
And
I'd like to see that.
My kids would tell you no. And so he actually just did in the background. But yeah, it's, you know, when
you
ask somebody and then you start pouring on follow-up questions, you know, it's, I've made people cry. As nice as I am, I've made people cry.
Well, that's part of the process.
Part of the process. Do the crime, you do the time.
Right.
So, you know, so that was very hard. And I don't think I had the judge's attention the way my adversary had it in the beginning. And, you know, we did not prevail, which was really sad. And you know, and then going back to, you know, square one, that was a case also where the intersection of autism, language impairment, and nonverbal intelligence was subtle, or maybe not so subtle, but it just was, the judge didn't have, didn't seem to get the connection in. And again, we were in the middle of a pandemic and the case manager testified that she managed 90 children.
Oh my gosh.
In an urban setting. And
how do you do that?
She doesn't.
Right.
So that's the problem.
Right.
That's the problem.
Yeah.
Is the, you know, she kind of in appears for crisis.
Right.
Appears for
the
mandatory reevaluation. Sometimes they get the parent to waive the reevaluation because they're so overwhelmed. That's a whole other pet peeve of mine. The district will say, oh, you know, we know the kid's eligible. We're not going to take away eligibility. You don't need the reevaluation now. Oh, wrong.
Wrong. Yep.
You know, we need, it's a GPS analogy. Where were you? Where are you now? How do you know without an evaluation? So we, you know, there were a lot of issues there, and it was frustrating. It was frustrating to, you know, to do a lot of repetition and scaffolding up so the judge would kind of follow the thread. And then, you know, ooh, shiny. He, you know, picked something out of the air and he was off. So, you know, nice man, but many people who read the opinion reached out to me to say that was not a good opinion. It wasn't just, you know, because he didn't prevail. There were plenty of times when a judge in denying your petition for due process will also put something very useful and instructive in the opinion, or they'll be creative about the timing of when they issue it, or there's, you know, something there that you don't mind losing because you, the client still
getting something
out of the proceeding. This was not that. And it just wasn't possible to take an appeal on this case. So how do you get, and again, to bring us back to the milestone of two cases on the opposite end, I certainly cited the case that I did win about saying that the student's nonverbal intelligence could not be discounted. And the judge followed the thread of the expert beautifully. And the basic underpinning of kids with autism and language impairments is when you give them the Wechsler IQ tests, you're asking them a question. They may know the answer, but they may not understand the question.
Right.
So you're automatically getting it wrong. And the only way to test somebody with a language impairment, whether it's due to autism or any other developmental delay, is to take the language out of that assessment. And
so are the judges educated on these things, Lenore, so that they have an understanding about something just like what you described?
Well, we expect that the expert testifying gives them a sufficient education to make a ruling. When we have continuing legal education, which is mandatory for all attorneys in, all over the country, that's pretty standard. The judges can access any of the continuing legal education offered in New Jersey, and judges don't pay. And there, of course, now everything's been remote for the last year and a half, going on two, but we're hoping when we go back in person, you know, to other things, we'll also have our continuing legal education in person. And we're well aware of the judges that are attending the same ones we're attending to gain more skill in these areas. But it's not mandatory. You know, again, most attorneys don't have my background.
Right. So. No, most attorneys, yeah, don't have your background. And I, you know, what you talked about, and I made a note about, you know, talking about these children called little professors with, you know, the high IQs, no friends, kind of get shoved to the side because of their quirkiness. You know, see a lot of that with the kids that are, you know, on the autism or Asperger spectrum. And, I find that the schools, it's so hard. You know, I don't definitely don't want to be negative on what teachers are doing, because, oh my gosh, they're doing so much and so much more than I think was even anticipated when they started teaching. But it seems like there is a lack of information or education or knowledge around some of these children who may not have been diagnosed yet, and they're not aware of what to look for or to speak up when they see something. And oftentimes these children are bullied or labeled and really don't start getting noticed till maybe they're 12, 13 years old. So it's been years of non-communication about, you know, what's actually going on with them. And it's been labeled bad behavior, so to speak.
Oh, yeah, there's plenty of that going around. Teachers get in-service training in their school districts. And, you know, if their master's is decades old, they're not required to take any more formal education. And how much can you cover in in-service education?
Right.
So, you know, really to keep up with state of the art, I gave a in-service, not in-service, you know, continuing education unit level course, lecture, whatever, to speech and language pathologists from the perspective of what do I look like? What do I look at when I'm looking at a report to decide whether it's credible, whether I should have somebody test the child further, all that. And, you know, I was trying to be as positive as I could and tell them, I understand the administration doesn't give you all the assessment tools. They don't give you a lot of time to do the writing, or, you know, they do load up a lot of kids in your caseload to test and to do therapy, and speech therapists and not usually the case managers, unless it's a speech only IEP. And they were tuning me out pretty roundly and soundly. They didn't want to hear anything. And I don't think they really wanted to, the group I was speaking to didn't seem all that interested in going out and advocating to do more, to be more useful to the students they serve, which was sad. Another time I spoke to a speech conference, you know, they couldn't get enough. They, you know, they came up after and, you know, asked me a lot of questions during the lunch and whatever. And so it varies, but I always, when I go to meetings, I say, I don't know, but when I was doing this back in the beginning, when the dinosaurs roamed and the law was brand new, I had more assessment tools in my room than you have. And I even, so in the case, you know, that I talked about winning with the nonverbal intelligence, one, there were two cases that were very similar, and it happened to have been the same expert in both, because when you know somebody that really knows tests of nonverbal intelligence inside and out, you say, this is the person I need to go back to for this particular case. So where was I going with this? So the ruling was, you know, that again, you can, you know, you do tease this out appropriately. And you would think once it's been decided and you're quoting it back to other judges, they'll say, oh, okay, Judge Monaco got this. So, you know, all I have to do is look at this and say, I have my guidance. It doesn't always work out that way. So, you know, you get into that space of, well, we thought everybody understood this because it's a published opinion.
But not necessarily.
Not so much. And in some ways it could be authoritative as, you know, a piece. But back to one of your other questions, it's, you know, what's appropriate. I mean, that's the I in the IEP.
Right.
So what's appropriate for this child is not appropriate for that child.
Right.
You know, and then when you look at the other end, the twice exceptional child, there's a little less sympathy for that, but it's still every voice matters. And when I represent a child with a very high IQ and a learning difference, the case that, again, we lost and we really looked to have some recourse, and I'll talk about that in a minute. It was the kid had an IQ of 133, and to this day has trouble writing a sentence because nobody really knows how to work with him. He's got some high functioning autism issues, and his pragmatics were very weak, and he would talk about the Titanic. That was it. No matter who met him, you had to hear about the Titanic, and the other kids, their eyes would roll and they'd walk away.
Right.
And, you know, the mom was able to stay at home with her kids at the time, who had volunteered to be class mother at these parties and all. And it was heartbreaking. She'd go time after time and see nobody talking to her kid. When he got out of district, he had a tribe. He had all these other quirky little professors, and suddenly everything flowed, because as you were talking about in your introduction, if you go to a school where they meet you where you are, rather than just shove this curriculum at you, no matter where you are.
It makes such a difference, such a huge difference.
Makes a huge difference. So socially, they got him out of his shell. And they got him to do an awful lot of creative, interesting work and feel good about himself as a learner. But the mechanics of writing and things like that, they didn't really keep up with what the parent was hoping for. There were many things that went wrong in that trial. And we did take an appeal. And the appeal came, the decision came down into COVID quite a while. In. And I think the judges were just getting pressure to issue opinions because nothing was coming out. And to us, it looked like, a law clerk look at it quickly. And they didn't really, the trial judge and the appellate judge, neither of them really reached this twice exceptional concept. So I wasn't happy with that at all. And I took the briefs to my assemblyman and said, Sterley, I need you to put forth a piece of legislation to close this gap. Now, the district in the trial in front of a judge said, I was cross-examining the learning disability teacher consultant about the educational testing, and I asked her if there was a significant discrepancy between the child's IQ and the written expression, I think we were on at the time, which is his biggest problem. And she said yes. And I said, you rejected eligibility on a specific learning disability. She said yes. She said, our director of special services said that if one of the scores is not in the below average range or lower than that, we adjust to ignore it.
Mm.
And the judge just sat there and I'm looking at the judge like, you know, this is gonna, you know, the administrative code doesn't have a carve out. Like, let's, you know, why don't you just thunder from the bench? Wait a minute, I gotta talk to the attorneys in chambers. You know, it happens plenty of times.
It does.
More cases settle before a decision than people realize. And so, you know, she's just sitting there listening, and I didn't know where to put myself. So
for parents.
Let me just finish the thought. Yeah.
Yeah.
So we briefed all of that. Like I said, she ignored it. The appellate judge ignored it. So I went to this assemblyman and we proposed legislation, which is now before the New Jersey Assembly, and they're not in session. So out of session, they're all working to get support for this, and everybody's writing to their own assembly person. That does correct that. That says, you know, we have to recognize the rights of a twice exceptional child. And if a child does score in an average range, but has potential that's, significantly higher than the average range, that is a disability, and you can't fail to do anything for that.
Yeah.
So I'm hoping that does pass. I hope the school board and all don't get behind some kind of opposition to that.
When parents have a child that's, nonverbal, how is it that they eventually come to that place of knowing that there's something more that their child needs, ends up not getting any help with the school district, and lands in your office?
You're going to be amused by this one.
Okay.
A huge number of parents come to us and say, the classroom teacher will deny saying this, but she said, get an attorney.
Really?
I was at a mediation this morning, and that's how my relationship with that client began. The classroom teacher said, get an attorney. And the district has been kicking the can down the road since sometime in 2019. We're still not resolved. Very dyslexic kid, and they're just being very, very stubborn about it. Word of mouth. There are parent groups all over the state. It's required by law that there should be a special education parent group in each district, and they should be given space to meet and all that. So they talk amongst themselves. And I've given talks at some of those special education parent groups. I've also given talks at focus groups. When a school that wants to open another branch of the school in New Jersey or in a second location in New Jersey or something of that stripe, a private school, they would come to me and say, we're going to do this. We're going to meet with people. And then people are always going to ask, well, how do you pay for this? This is expensive.
Mm-hmm.
And would you come and explain the process? And I've done that many times. Also putting it out there, I can't guarantee you that if you retain me, I'm getting this school for you.
Right.
But I will, guide you accordingly to an appropriate education.
Never a guarantee.
So that's another big, and then of course, satisfied clients referring other friends and family. We get another one that's going to surprise you. We get a lot of referrals made by other board attorneys. So if Mr. A is representing the school district, they won't refer that family to me, but if Mr. B is representing the school district, Mr. A will say, this is what you need. Although in one case, a board attorney kind of filtered his recommendation for the parent to come to me through somebody else. And I found out, we talked later, and it was a very, very sad case. Senior teenage girl and very complicated stuff going on. And the attorney said to me, I asked whoever had reached out for a recommendation to recommend you because they need a Jewish mother as much as a good attorney. That's true. It was a mess. It was a hot mess. The parents weren't on the same page.
That makes it even worse. Yep.
Yep.
You work just in the state of New Jersey, is that correct?
We have one attorney lives in Pennsylvania, and I believe she's admitted in Pennsylvania, but it's like I said, I don't think she's practicing there. We don't, there are, you know, there are a lot of us now. When we started, there weren't so many.
So for our listeners who I want to make sure they do know how to reach out to you, Lenore, and have your information either for additional questions or, you know, potentially needing your services. What is the best way for them to get in touch with you?
The best way is probably email, because of the pandemic, we're not in the office every day. So
okay.
I do pick up phone remotely, but if you want me to put it in the chat?
Yes, you know, no, just go ahead and share it and make sure that it's available also in print later.
Oh, okay. My email is Lenore, L-E-N-O-R-E, all lowercase, at S as in Sam, G as in girl, W as in water, lawfirm, all one word,
.com.
Yeah,
I just want to make sure. And then, yes, I will make sure that people have your full contact information as well.
Thank you very much. Yeah, because, you know, we're connected with all of our devices to email. And, you know, as soon as I see an email, you know, I'll scan it for.
You're very responsive. I have found.
Thank you. My clients are used to me, they get I had an away message when I was away and answered somebody and she said, not now, you're on the case and you've earned it. And that was nice because another time when I had an away message, a client said, yeah, I know your mother just died, but.
Oh, no. Oh, my goodness.
I had witnesses to that one.
Yeah, well, you know, sometimes people in their emotional states just are not thinking clearly. So.
Well, we're used to it. We're dealing with somebody's children.
And you are. Lots of stress.
It's really awesome that people trust us with their most precious gift is their children.
I can just say in working with you myself, you know, I have referred other families to you, would not hesitate to refer families to you.
Thank you.
And
great.
Seems like there is a lot that's always going on in the state of New Jersey, you know, education wise. And there's so much more I would, you know, love for us to, you know, have more time to talk about. I'd love to have you come back again and share more. I just think some of the cases that you're working on, the legislation aspect of what you're doing, you know, and I have to go back to my note. I really, you know, I looked this up, the Brain Injury Alliance of New Jersey, you know, what's taking place there. Just, you know, some wonderful things are happening.
Yeah, unfortunately, between some other things before the pandemic and the pandemic, we don't meet regularly. But during the time that we did, we forged some really good friendships and professional connections. So, you know, I'm very confident that if somebody had a child with a brain injury or an adult for that matter, you know, I could connect them with the best of the best in the brain injury world.
So what would you like to leave people with today, especially for those who are probably needing to reach out to a special education attorney and just aren't sure about taking that step and what that might mean for them?
I would say, when in doubt, go on a fact-finding mission. If you think your child is struggling and you think your child shouldn't be struggling, or you know your child is struggling and the school's telling you, no, they're fine, you should refer your child to the child study team in writing, because all the phone calls and face-to-face meetings are not legally relevant. You have to have your paper trail.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, then depending on what happens with child study, you have a decision tree. If child study says, okay, we'll do this and that, and you again, if your gut says that might not be it, then I would get a special education attorney involved before I would go get an expert report and all that. And, you know, again, the quick version of why in that order would be because somebody could be fabulous in their field and you get the report and you go to the child study team and they don't agree. And then you tell them this is going to a hearing. Oh, I don't do that. I don't testify. Sadly, there are people that don't feel comfortable with the process.
Okay.
And, you know, and sometimes the report just isn't written in a format that's going to be helpful to the family.
Okay.
So, you know, we vet the people that we recommend to families very carefully, read redacted reports, interview them. If we recommend somebody to a family, it might not be who they chose and it might not be maybe even their favorite person, but the person's going to be appropriately skilled to do the job.
Okay. Thank you so much for being here today.
Again, thank you for inviting me.
And would love to have you back again. There's just so much more, I think, for people to learn about what you're doing and how involved you are in so many of the kids that you're advocating for. And thank you for doing that because they
thanks really a lot. I appreciate that. That means a lot coming from you.
You know, again, I want to thank Lake Tahoe Preparatory School for sponsoring our show today and supporting us. Lake Tahoe Preparatory School, they meet students where they are in their academic journey. They champion lifelong intellectual curiosity, physical fitness, and personal resilience. They achieve 100% university acceptance, and their students graduate ready to learn, ready to launch, and ready to lead. It's a great school in California. You can go to their website and learn a lot more information at laketahoeprep.org. You can also schedule a campus visit by calling 530-583-8665. Our guest next week is going to be Molly Baker with Molly Dog Training, and she's going to talk about the difference between service dog, emotional support animals, and therapy dogs, and the laws that surround them. I know there's been a great interest in this in the past. I expect some questions will be coming in, and Molly is a wonderful trainer as well. I follow her on Facebook, and I think you'll find some valuable information. Today's saying actually came from a neighbor of mine whose husband recently was diagnosed with early Alzheimer's. He's just in his 50s. And she says, write down all the great things you can about someone that you know and love and make sure that they hear it, send it to them. Be a ray of sunshine and make their day better. Sometimes people don't know how much we appreciate about them, and it can really brighten somebody's day to remind them of how valuable they are to us and important in our life. Thank you for being here today. Every voice matters. I'm Dori Francis, and I will look forward to seeing you next week, Thursday, 11 a.m. Pacific, 12 noon Mountain. Take care, everyone. Bye-bye.
You're listening to Every Voice Matters with Dori Francis, only on LA Talk Radio.